And good evening and welcome to the Digital Finance Analytics live stream event for the 16th of July, 2019. Believe it or not, this is actually the 13th and 14th times that I've run these live streams. So we've been doing it for over a year now, quite remarkable. And always find plenty to talk about, so I don't think we'll have any problems tonight. But good to see you all on. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, of course, here. And I'll be conducting you through tonight's conversations. As normal, what we're going to do is to just make a few opening remarks. From there, we will then go into the Q&A section. And depending on how that goes, we may well get to some of the questions I've received beforehand. In fact, I had so many questions beforehand that what I've done is I've arranged them into categories of topics. And if we don't actually touch on those topics because of the questions live stream, what I'll do is I will nevertheless go for those as we go through the evening. So that's what we're going to do. So just to explain, I am going to look away from the chat at the moment. Quite a few more people joining, and it's good to see you all. I can't acknowledge every single one of you, but what I will say to you is that the live stream replay will include all of the participants as well, so you can actually see the conversation on replay if you want to. So let's go forward and start with the normal stuff. So just the running order for today. This introduction which we've had, talk about the house rules. Talk about our models just briefly so people are aware of how we do what we do. Some key slides, again, just setting some context. Some questions and answers, that'll be the bulk of the time. And then we'll sign off. Generally, these sessions go for about an hour and a half, plus or minus, but it depends a little bit on what happens in terms of the conversation. We might get deep into something, or we might find we ran out of things to say after 30 minutes. We'll see. I have to say, I've never gone for less than an hour and 20, so I suspect that's the sort of time that we should expect to spend together tonight. And it's really great that you've chosen to come and spend some of your valuable time with me. I really do appreciate it. Okay, house rules. Please note this is not financial advice. So one of the critical things to underscore is we are not a financial advice firm. We are not qualified to do that. And therefore, anything we say is based very much on our own analysis an interpretation of what's going on. There are limits to how far we can take the discussion. Now, we do have associates on the channel who are qualified advisors, and where they're qualified, we do call those out, and of course they can provide advice, but we're not providing financial advice here tonight. It's very important for you to understand that. Secondly, please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs, please. We are actively monitoring and moderating the stream, and people will be chopped if they are actually abusive or if they're actually just highly repetitive and those sorts of things, just to keep the stream free. The point there is we've got a very, very vibrant community, a lot of very smart people with really interesting ideas. I want to see those ideas come out. I just don't want it to get contaminated with racial slurs and stupidity. So we do actively monitor. Now, this is actually at the 16th of July, 2019, if you're watching this later. I could well be wrong. You know, this is my opinion based on what I've seen at the moment. Things change, therefore, if you're playing this in the future sometime, you'll know whether I was right or whether I was wrong or whether I was, completely barking up the wrong tree. If you want to get my attention, please use at Walk the World. That's my handle, and that will make sure that I see the things that you say. There is always plenty of chat going on the channel. I can't necessarily see all the posts, and so it really helps to use that Walk the World. You can, of course, use Super Chat, and that Super Chat allows you to do two things. One, if you want to, you can make a financial contribution to help us continue to develop the channel. We're very, very appreciative of all those who do support us. We don't make any money out of what we do. Every dollar that we actually generate goes back into creating more content and making more stuff for the channel. Secondly, if you do want your question to go to the top of the list and be the focus of attention, Super Chat enables you to do that too. So that is there if you'd like to use it. No pressure, but if you do. What I won't do is give everybody a today. I got a few pieces of feedback last time that said repetition of today was a bit too much, so I'll just acknowledge rather than actually use my catchphrase. Can't win all the time, can you? Okay, so just in terms of the core model, this is the model, of course. This is how we do what we do. Our research is based on a household survey, 52,000 households over a year, more than 4,500 each month. They feed our industry model, core market model, that drives all our analysis. So a lot of what we do is a combination of our household surveys and, of course, also very importantly, the information that's available from the RBA and ABS and other public sources, and also public information from various clients that effectively put out their annual accounts and those sorts of things. So there's quite a rich range of material that we use, but then we put it in the core market model, and that then drives oral analysis and modeling, all those things. And when you see the charts that I create, quite often it's out of the core market model. We also slice and dice all sorts of different ways. It's very important because you'll keep hearing me say averaging doesn't tell you anything. And the point of is that you've got to go into granularity. You've got to see how different behaviours are impacting different groups of households. And so we can slice it by property status, geography, and even our master segmentation as well. So a few quick things. The first thing to say is housing credit is still growing, but more slowly. And this is actually information to the end of May from Reserve Bank. So owner-occupied housing is growing at 5.3% on an annualized basis. Investor credit is only 0.5%. Other personal credit is dropping. It was down 3.2% over the last year. And even business is lending is down a little, and total credit growth is 3.6%. Now, the Reserve Bank in their minutes today did actually say that their expectation was that the rate of credit growth may move a little, but not dramatically up. But they really were quite non-committal. They were talking about all of the negativity in the economy with low growth and those sorts of things. Although they are still predicting that the GDP will come back. But then, of course, they said that they might watch, I think, for a little while, although some have interpreted that as still saying that there's more downside on the RBA. So we'll see. But anyway, the point is housing credit growth is slowing. That's important because we have this thing called credit momentum. Credit momentum is the rate of change of credit. And those of you who listened to Steve Keen talking to me the other day will know he described perfectly this issue of the relationship between the rate of change of credit and home prices. Basically, if it slows, home prices drop. If the rate of change of credit rises, home prices rise. So that's one of the reasons why we're still quite negative in terms of home prices ahead. Just in terms of new finance approvals, the point to make there is that pretty much all categories, whether you're an upgrader, whether you're an investor, whether you're a foreign buyer, they're all dropping dramatically. First-time buyers are a little bit stronger than they were, you know, this time last year, but of course it's a relatively small proportion, so first-time buyers are not going to save us. Property investors still not really making a lot of headway. Now, of course, all this information is still before the rate cuts, but as we'll talk later, we discover quite soon that in fact rate cuts may not translate to more momentum in the housing sector from our surveys. Household confidence is in fact in the gutter, and this was interesting. There was a small bump of confidence, a small rise in confidence after the election, but that's gone away again, and households are pretty negative about their own finances at the moment, and that's because incomes are flat, cost of living are rising. And of course, as yet, those cheaper mortgages haven't necessarily followed through to cheaper money coming in each month, you know, because your repayments are lower, if in fact you do decide to make your payments lower. Also, CoreLogic published this to say that more property sales are now made at a loss. And in fact, the average duration of a property sold is 6.3 years or something like that, more than 6 years. And units are particularly being sold at a loss at the moment. Many of those are investors, so people are trying to get shot. And in fact, people are trying to sell into the slight upward movement in momentum in the market that we've seen. A lot of those are property investors, and a lot of those people are also in high rises, and we'll come back to that a bit later. Now, the BBSW, the funding cost has dropped dramatically. You can see there that we're 99.2 basis points from peak. This is remarkable. This is a big turnaround, reflecting international interest rates dropping and also local rates. And I also think the Reserve Bank's manipulation of their open money operations. Trade balance, of course, was up in May. It was actually one of the biggest numbers, $5.75 billion. And that was helped essentially by massive support from the iron ore sector. We're actually importing a little, relatively less as well, which is the other point there. But the question is the iron ore price, where does it go next? It's 121.18 this morning. And you can see there that when Vale fell over, that's from Brazil, of course, that's the Brazilian operation, when that effectively stopped them producing the iron ore, the price has run up. There was a bit of a downtick just over a week ago over here when China said that they would actually be looking very hard at the prospective manipulation of the iron ore price and perhaps we're going to take a few steps. Haven't seen much results of that, but of course the iron ore price is very high. And the key point here to make is that it's the iron ore price that is supporting the economics of our country at the moment to an amazing extent. And really, there isn't a lot else going on other than the iron ore price. Now, what BIS said in their annual report just out was that you can't rely on monetary policy alone to stimulate the economy and to create greater growth. And our growth levels, of course, are very low at the moment, much lower than people expected. And the prospects are probably lower growth ahead. In fact, the household sector is pretty weak. The business sector is pretty weak. The only growth areas are the resource exports. And the other point to make there is that really there isn't a lot of headway. I just want to acknowledge Glenys. Glenys, thank you so much for your contribution. Really appreciate it. And thanks for your best wishes for my wife too. It really is appreciated. Thank you. So the BIS said you can't just rely on monetary policy. You've got to do other things, infrastructure, investment, fiscal and a few other things. And of course, that echoes some of the conversations from Fabric Low. There was little in the notes from the meeting today that they held a couple of weeks ago. And I don't know whether you watched Fabric Low and the Treasurer together. But what was interesting there was I felt rather as though the Treasurer was exerting some influence on the Reserve Bank and their comments. Of course, the problem is debt-driven, basically. If you look at the average full-time earnings relative to dwelling prices, you can see that since 1995, they've shot through the roof. And that's partly because of the deregulation of the financial system, partly because lending standards were relaxed, partly because there was a lot more people coming in for investment properties and foreign buyers, all of that. But you can see that the impact is that dwelling prices have really accelerated away, and that's why more households are in more debt today than before. It's also worth saying the jobs data was pretty mixed. Underemployment was up a bit. Unemployment was lifting. The Reserve Bank, of course, wants to get unemployment down to 4 point something. And the question is, are they likely to? My own view, it's quite difficult to see how they're going to do that, specifically because the underemployment number is growing and it's above where it was in the GFC. And the last point before we move on is to just talk about the cladding. Of course, Victoria announced today that they were going to provide $600 million of assistance to help those properties, around something like 400 properties that have been identified as high risk with inflammable cladding. And that's about one third of the properties that were actually surveyed. And what that basically means is that we are in a situation where it's not clear precisely what's going to happen to other states. The feds are basically saying, no, nothing to do with us, it's all down to the states. But everybody is now recognizing that the poor certification processes, the low standards, are very structurally concerning. And we've got thousands and thousands of properties potentially with faulty cladding, not only in the domestic setting, but also in the commercial setting too. So this is a big deal. This could cost billions. And so it must be said, this is one of the critical reasons why I think that property prices are going to remain depressed, particularly in the high rise. I just noticed that somebody made the point that, of course, Glass-Steagall was also repealed and that allowed more of this stupid lending to happen. So thanks for that, Joe. Okay, just in terms of our scenarios, as you know, we drive this off the core market model. The scenario is just a way of thinking about what's going on. They're not meant to be a forecast. What I try to do is to say, well, if you sort of compare with where we were a few months ago, what's it like in 2 to 3 years' time? And that gives us a bit of a horizon. So we basically say, what happens to the Reserve Bank rate? What's going to happen to unemployment, mortgage stress? bank losses, home prices, and the sorts of things that may be happening. And we rate each one by probability. And frankly, last time there was a big change. This time there's not a lot of change. So effectively, we've got pretty much no change for our business as usual, the RBA scenario. If they do get unemployment down to 4.5%, mortgage stress will drop a little from where it is. It's at 32% at the moment. Home prices will probably rise just a little over 2 to 3 years, not a lot, just a little. And we'll see, you know, QE and all those things. 15% probability last time, 15% probability this time. The next one is, are things going to get better scenario? So that's where effectively things don't work out. Unemployment continues to rise. The Reserve Bank cuts some more. Mortgage stress rises. Losses in banks arrive. But home prices, whilst they might go up a little for a small amount of time, effectively turn around and go south again. And over the next 2 or 3 years, they will end 10 to 15% lower. And there will be further easing. There'll be fiscal stimulus and all those things. About 25% probability. So we've actually upped the probability of that. And the reason we've done that is that there is very little evidence from our household surveys of more appetite to buy property at the moment. A lot of the activity which we're seeing was a little bit of pent up from first-time buyers, but property investors really aren't that keen. What we are seeing, though, is a lot of activity to refinance to lower rates, which may give some real room for some. The next one is not yet doomsday. So this is essentially when we might see rates really, really low, unemployment rising higher, mortgage stress is higher, home prices will drop further over this scenario in two to three years. And that now has a probability of 15%. So I've taken that down slightly based on the research that I've done. And I've basically moved the probability up towards some things only get better slightly. So what I'm saying is that the overall impact on home prices is probably a little lower than we were seeing 2 or 3 months ago and even last month, based on what I'm seeing from my surveys. Then we just look at the last two. The Armageddon one now moved up to 30%. This is the really serious one. So this basically assumes an international crisis comes in over the top. There is a long story here to be told, but in short, you know, the US, China, Brexit, a lot of other activities around the world are all looking quite concerning, the Middle East. So if one of those blows up, then we could actually see liquidity issues in the banking system, and that will flow through a bit like we had 10, 11 years ago. 30% chance of that happening. And then we've got the last one, which is the doomsday. And basically the difference between doomsday and Armageddon is that for various reasons, we end up with bank failures. And there is still a chance, a reasonable chance that may happen. I'm concerned by Deutsche Bank, for example, as to what that may do to the local banks and the international situation as well. So you can see that the summary really shows that it is fundamentally a lot of different scenarios that could play out. There is no one that's now standing out, whereas previously they used to be. And that's because the Reserve Bank has started to cut rates. So that's where we are at the moment. There is no definitive information from my surveys which really confirms absolutely how this may play out yet. We'll continue to monitor the surveys, and as we get more information, maybe that will change. I just want to acknowledge Genevieve. Thank you very much, Genevieve. Appreciate your contribution. Thank you. It really does help. Okay, so there we go. I hope that was useful in terms of context selling. Let's now go to the Q&A. And so I'm going to look up the list and just see what questions we've got. I'm going to be looking at where there was a Walk the World conversation. Okay, various people suggesting other people I might debate with. Metal says, your content is awesome. Thank you, I really appreciate that. We do try. and Nicole says, when are you going to open the Walk the World Credit Union? Yeah, there's a few things that I have to think about to do that, you know. But frankly, there are some good credit unions around there who are doing well. Paola, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, so I'm just going up the list, see what we've got. Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to start with. Let's have a look. Just catching up. Just bear with me a second. Okay. Yes. Some people are suggesting that Peter Switzer and Chris Joyce are here somewhere. I don't know. Hi there, Bruce from Perth. Okay, so Alan says, why is a scenario in which the Reserve Bank just keeps printing money not likely? Now, they probably will print money. The question is whether it will be effective, right? The thing you need to understand is that if you look back over Europe, if you look back in the US, there was a lot of money printing that went on. It's still going on. You know, the ECB is still doing it. The Fed is still doing it. Even Japan has been doing it. The point, though, is that printing money and just doing quantitative easing has not proven to solve anything. So it may well be that it puts off the moment of truth, but all it does is to take interest rates ever lower and inflate asset prices. Now, asset prices predominantly will be initially shares, and that is because as people effectively are looking for somewhere to invest, because they've suddenly got, for example, corporate entities, who buy some of the bonds and what have you. So there is a need for investment, and stock markets tend to rise. And of course, in some cases, home prices to some extent, although not as much as stock prices. The other thing that happens is that many corporates will borrow at very, very low rates and will be able to buy back shares so that effectively their share price rises. And a lot of the activity in the US over the last 2 years, if you look at it carefully, has been from corporates simply buying back shares and lifting their share price, which means that shareholders get a short-term glow of satisfaction because their prices are higher. But they're not investing in their businesses. They're not actually creating momentum into the future. And that's the problem. So QE doesn't necessarily solve anything. And in fact, some of the latest research that I've been reading suggests that QE is actually way more negative, because what it does, it takes interest rates ever lower. It actually inflates certain types of assets. It includes effectively transference of value to those people who hold shares. And that's a proportion of the population, but not all the population. So what it does is effectively provide an asset spike and a wealth spike to a small proportion of the population, whilst the rest of the population, those reliant on savings in particular, are a real struggle, because effectively the rates they get on the savings go lower and lower. If you look in the UK, savings rates there have been 0.5% or lower, which means that basically a lot of pensioners, a lot of people who were reliant on those savings, are struggling, continue struggling. Here in Australia, we're finding the same now with low interest rates. A lot of people who were relying on those savings from their term deposits are now unable to make ends meet. So QE is not a solution. And my suggestion is that therefore it's unlikely that we're going to be able to see a turnaround based on quantitative easing, despite the fact that all the banks, of course, have been calling for it. Why? Because it helps them. Because they get funding very cheaply that they can then lend out to make more money. They can effectively play the market as well, speculate, but it doesn't necessarily solve the fundamental economic dilemma that we have, which is we have a very narrow economy. We have an economy that's highly leveraged, and we have effectively no growth, and that's the problem. Okay. Paradigm shifts. Who dissed your catchphrase? Yeah, thank you. Well, I can't. It just proves you cannot win, because whatever I say, somebody's going to love it, somebody's going to hate it. But a few people said, hey, come on. There were so many people, wanting to use Super Chat that the day's got in the way. So I'm just trying it a different way. We'll see how it works. We might change it later. I'm happy to give it a bit. Right, what's this one? Okay, so Lot Aussie says, the economy needs to change direction away from relying on housing and rebuild a manufacturing industry. Well, you've put your finger on the absolute critical issue, right? So what we've done for a generation is we've relied on construction, we've relied on debt, we've relied on bigger mortgages, we've relied on making our banks grow, because of course as they lend more, prices are bid up. As prices are bid up, they can lend more. So it's that sort of momentum. And as you may know, it's very important to understand that the old fractional reserve theory of how banking works is not right. Banks can effectively create loans out of thin air. And as they have need to create loans, that's what they do. Then what they do is to generate assets, and that could be a deposit, or it could be property, whatever it is, a mortgage or whatever it is. But the point is that the banks can create, and they will go on creating for as far and as long as there are people willing to borrow. And that growth engine is very, very risky, because it sucks investment out of real constructive stuff. Manufacturing is a very good example, but other industry is also finding it quite difficult to be able to get the sort of investment that they want. In our SME surveys, we're finding more and more SMEs are saying, we just cannot get banks to fund the growth of our business at the moment. And they're all pretty iffy anyway, because of the negative vibes that are coming through. They're not seeing, for example, their customers buying much from them. So many businesses are struggling. But the real point is that the base, which is agricultural to an extent, although that's being impacted by the drought, of course, the resource sector, which is predominantly iron ore and coal, and then the rest. And it's the rest that's the problem, because we do not have a strategy. The government doesn't have a strategy in terms of driving new stuff, innovation, those sorts of things. I guess Malcolm Turnbull tried, but basically it didn't go anywhere. And so we have an economy that is very narrowly based, economy which is myopically aligned to construction, housing, home lending, the banking sector. You know, the stock market, if you look at it, is largely made up of financial services companies and miners. We don't have a real good broad-based economy. And the trouble is that none of those in power are, one, wanting to recognise that that's a real problem, and two, are not proposing plans to address it. And that's a big deal. Ambidex says massive capital gains coming. Yeah, there will be. That's what QE does, right? So QE creates asset prices artificially high. That creates capital gains in the short term. But the question is it sustainable, right? What you're actually doing is just kicking the can down the road. You're not fundamentally dealing with the fundamental disruptive structure of the economy. We've got more debt than ever before. We've got $1 trillion overseas that we owe as a country. We've got massive amounts of household debt, and that's the problem. So, yeah, while it might superficially look fun, below the surface, it's not necessarily that good. Okay, who else? Metals Crypto says, been waiting for a doomsday scenario for 3 years, it better hurry. Look, the point here is, I don't think this is going to happen immediately. It could. You know, one of the things that JA says is that, sometimes these things happen. You know, for example, if Deutsche Bank fell over, right, that would potentially have a significant impact on the interbank trust levels and liquidity levels, and that could actually flow on and create, that could happen quite quickly. And if you look at, more than a decade ago, the concerns in the US and in, for example, the UK about bank failures meant that decisions had to be taken over a weekend to try and stop the system falling over. So at one end of the spectrum, there is always that risk. But my own view is that it's more likely to play out over the medium term, because we're going to continue to see central banks cut rates more. We know that the Fed is likely to cut in July, towards the end of July when they meet. We would expect the Reserve Bank to cut later in the year again. We would expect other countries around the world to also take those similar steps, because everything is indicating that growth overall is easing back. Now, of course, I quoted the BIS earlier on, and basically the BIS said, don't rely on monetary policy to get us out of this hole, because it is not capable of doing it. And I think it's very interesting that the BIS, the banker's banker, is basically saying to central bankers, you can't expect monetary policy to solve the problem. Here's the thing. Most central banks have got into the habit of believing that they can manipulate their interest rate a little bit, and magically it'll all flow through, and they can actually press the accelerator and the brake, and it's rubbish, they can't. The mechanism is somewhat broken. In fact, some would say it's completely broken, yet they're still trying to do it. And essentially there's a lower bounds beyond which it's really almost impossible to recover. So if they drop rates so low, going to QE, then going to negative rates, it's very, very hard to climb back. look at Japan, who's actually been in this sort of doldrum state for, well, 20 years now, 15, 20 years, and they have not found a way back. And that's the concern I have. So essentially, we have to find a different approach. But my point is, doomsday won't necessarily come this week or next week. It may well be 2 or 3 years down the track. But it's hard to see how we can avoid it unless, as the BIS says, people actually think differently about the problem. Yeah, Raymond says weak industrial sector, weak economy. Well, you're right. Yeah. And it's interesting if you look in even places like Germany, right, where they've got a stronger manufacturing base and more local banks and a few other things that are working for them. Even there, the economy is not as strong as perhaps they would like to see it. So it is tricky to try and do this in a globalized world because, of course, we've got very cheap production in other countries, particularly in Asia. I'm watching China, of course, India, places like that. So in a way, once the globalization door is open, then the full draft of international competition and international pay rates are there to be negotiated. And the question is, can we think of, you know, are we creative enough to think of industries that can really add value? Or do we just default back to services? And that's the problem, I think, at the moment, because essentially we've sort of almost assumed that we can't win on the manufacturing side, so therefore it's the services side. But my view has always been that we actually, if we applied some real innovation and some new thinking and, you know, think of the way to apply new technologies and those sorts of things, there is plenty of opportunity to create new stuff. And that would put us in much better stead. But unfortunately, the conditions are not right at the moment to make that happen. We'll look. Christopher says, can you comment on Deutsche Bank and what impact you think it could have on Australian property and the banking sector? Sure. Yeah, so Deutsche Bank, now Deutsche Bank has been in the doldrums for a long, long time. They were bailed out by the Fed around the time of the GFC. They've had this massive exposure of derivatives, 41 trillion people are quoting. I think that's probably, you know, maybe an underestimate, not sure. They have effectively skinned back. What they're doing, of course, is now jettisoning parts of their business. They're closing down some of their international divisions. There are job losses in Australia. But the thing to understand is that the Deutsche Bank that's left, which is the bit that's effectively the more typical bank in Germany, has been the least profitable part of the entire organisation. So effectively, as they jettison their more profitable, more risky investment banking operations, what's left? And that's really the question. So many people would say that Deutsche Bank has passed the point of a return in terms of being able to solve their problems. And now, there have been 4 or 5 or 6 different types of restructures and approaches over the years, but none of it's actually worked. So I guess the question first is it likely that this is any different or we're going to actually see a different outcome this time? And the answer is, I don't know. It's too soon to say, but I think the bets are off of it actually succeeding, in my view. That's my humble opinion. In terms of what would happen, look, it could play out a few different ways, but let's assume that, in fact, Deutsche Bank gets into serious difficulty and essentially the international capital markets freeze up again. If you go back to the GFC, it was actually the trust between banks that basically froze liquidity. That meant that banks couldn't get liquidity. They couldn't know who to trust. They didn't know whether the securitized pools of assets that they held were worth anything at all, or were they worth completely nothing. And so it became a trust-related thing, and it became a feedback loop. And as the feedback contagion spread, then more and more banks got into more difficulty because banks effectively need liquidity all the time. So if you think about bank funding, there is some long-term bank funding, but there's quite a lot of short-term funding, let's say 90 days. And so that 90-day funding needs to be continued to be refreshed on an ongoing basis. And if in fact it's true that the international capital markets are frozen, you can't actually get that 90-day funds. And so very quickly, banks get into difficulty, and once they get into difficulty, they can't lend. The cost of money goes up, and they can get into very deep difficulty quite quickly. Now, how would that play out? Well, If we got the situation where the international capital markets really started to freeze, our banks in Australia, the big four particularly, are very reliant on access to those international markets to maintain their lines of credit and their balance sheets. So they would have to turn firstly to the Reserve Bank, and there is the committed liquidity facility, which APRA and the Reserve Bank basically put together, which means they could be supported for a period of time. But that probably wouldn't be sufficient to get them out of the hole. And then the question is, well, what do they do? Do they basically stop lending? If they do that, their profitability goes through the floor. Do they get help from the government? You know, some sort of nationalisation or part nationalisation or something like that. Or do they get to the point where effectively they need to be restructured? And that's, of course, where deposit bail-in and those sorts of things may even come in as part of that. None of that is very good for people with mortgages and people who are effectively looking to borrow. So the chances are that if the banks really get into difficulty, that would be more downward pressure on the housing market. And that's one of the reasons why in my scenarios, I always talk about the fact that in this situation where liquidity basically froze, home prices would drop significantly. Remember that in Ireland they dropped more than 40%, in areas in the US it was 40%, in England it was 35 to 40%, and in the UK and in the US it took nearly a decade for it to recover. So if you go that route, then you must expect home prices to be much lower, and that's why, you know, I'm still arguing that home prices even today are 40% over what they should be on an absolute basis, just taking account of the true value of property. All the rest of it is froth. So we have home prices that are still massively high relative to where they should be. And what that basically means is that there is a significant risk to home prices if in fact a bank fail follows through. And Deutsche Bank is probably right at the top of the list. It's not the only one. There's a few others around the world. More failures in China possibly as well. But really, Deutsche Bank is probably one of the biggest. It will be way bigger than Lehman's. And the question is, would it be allowed to fail? Probably not. German government would probably bail it out in some form if it actually got into difficulty. But the derivatives bill is huge. That would impact the financial markets dramatically. And therefore, you could see how the dominoes could fall over. So that's my scenario as to how Deutsche Bank could play into this. Okay. Lovely one from Jonathan Pace. What's your thoughts on the property super cycle that is being spruced by the property experts? Yeah. Isn't it interesting how watching what's been going on? So I don't know whether you're in receipt of some of the emails that I am, but you know, I subscribe to various property experts, quote unquote, and they're all basically saying, huh, great time to buy, bottom of the market, you know, prices are going to go up. It's just a matter of how much. And of course, BIS, Oxford Economics, basically said, well, Brisbane prices could go up 20% in the next 3 years, you know, not so good in Sydney and Melbourne. So some of the analysts, they are peddling the same dope, as it were. A lot of the property experts are coming back to interest rates are really low, therefore much more affordable, therefore go buy. And of course, they then cite the auction clearance rates, which, well, might be slightly higher, but you've got to understand how they calculate the clearance rates. We've done a post on this some time back. Remember that they start with the listed numbers of auctions, but then completely drop that and focus only on those reported. And then it's the proportion that are actually reported relative to the ones sold that actually are used to calculate pretty much the clearance rate. But the trouble is that clearance rate is on a very small number. So the volume of sales are still way down from where they were. Second point is, if you look carefully, some of the indices now include a wider geographic area. In fact, Joe Wilkes was telling me, I think it's probably in the post that went up today, that in New Zealand, they used to report the auction clearance rates in Auckland separately from the rest of the country. But now, because Auckland is really wobbly, they're now suddenly reporting on an aggregated basis, because essentially that hides the bad news in Auckland. Well, I can tell you there are somewhat similar things going on here in Australia. So if you look carefully, there is Central Coast data now in some of the clearance rates that are being quoted. Never used to be, but it is. So you need to check the total geographic footprint, and then you need to look at the relative proportion of listed to reported, and of course then what proportion of those reported actually end up being sold. And there are a lot being passed in. There is a little bit more momentum than there was, but off very low numbers. And so I'm afraid that I don't believe the auction results really demonstrate yet the market has woken up. Everyone's been saying that there's been massive increases in mortgage applications. The truth there is that a lot of those mortgage applications are refinancing of existing loans to get cheaper loans. And that's good stuff, you know, because you can actually save a mozza if you're actually a low-risk borrower with a good credit history, with a relatively low loan-to-value ratio. You can get a lot of those really cheap rates now. And, you know, frankly, if you haven't done that, probably should. Word to the wise, if you're on a variable rate and you know you don't have a 3, have a 4 or something, have a look around. You can probably get a better rate. But there are around a quarter or thereabouts of those people who are looking to refinance who are unable to refinance because they don't fit the credit standards that now the banks have set. And they're the ones that actually are already finding it quite difficult. So that's another reason why I don't think property is necessarily going to bounce back. Third point to make is the property investors overseas still are there. I was amazed to see something in the newspaper the other day saying, oh, of course, Chinese investors are coming back like in droves. No, they're not. No, they're not. Very little evidence of Chinese investors coming back. Of course, China changed the rules to make it harder to get money out of China. And then you've got the high-rise conundrum and the issues to do with the cladding, as we discussed earlier on. Those are having a serious impact on the high-rise sector. I'm not seeing any improvement yet in high-rise at all. There's a little bit of improvement in some inner suburban houses, particularly older properties on big plots where there is essentially limited supply and some demand. But if you go beyond that, if you go out to the urban fringe, we've got all this new stuff being built. There's very little evidence of anything happening other than people struggling to sell, trying to get out. If you look over in the West, we've got 3% of defaults over there now. A lot of the people over there are being forced to sell. So, you know, the balanced view of what's going on, and, you know, I try to keep a balanced view, is, yeah, there is a little improvement in the odd place, but there is certainly not enough to justify the spruiking that the property sector is going through. And of course, it's supported by the banks because they want to lend more. And in fact, again, in New Zealand, we've seen some of the banks, frankly, being relatively untruthful about what's been going on and, you know, encouraging people to go buy now. They have an agenda. The property sector has an agenda. The construction sector has an agenda, right? And of course, they all want to talk this thing up. And the government has an agenda because essentially its growth engine for the last decade has been property. It's been construction and it's been bank lending for mortgages. So there's a lot of people all on the same side of the equation, but it doesn't make it right. And let's wait and see. There may be some positive news over the next few months. You know, we'll see. And if there is, I'll adjust my scenarios accordingly. But I'm not seeing it in my household survey data. I'm not seeing it in consumers. I'm not seeing a rise in the appetite to go buy property at the moment. And therefore, I'm still pretty sure that we're in for a long, slow drag. And as I said in my scenarios earlier on, more likely to be down than up in 3 years' time. Okay. What else have we got? Okay, Cookie Boy says, what's your view on Chinese GDP? 6.2 or more like 2.6? Well, of course, the Chinese GDP is weakest now than it's been for a good number of years. They bring up the number very quickly. And I guess part of the question there is how well is the data, you know, produced? Is it accurate? A lot of people would suggest that it's a lot higher than it truly is. It's hard to know, really. But what you can say is that they are doing a lot of things to try and support their economy. So, for example, they've taken down the capital ratios for the banks so they can actually hold lower capital to allow them to lend more. They're doing more stimulation in terms of the residential construction sector. They're trying to effectively do more building, more infrastructure. So China is doing quite a lot to try and support its economy. They are being impacted by the trade wars with the US, there's no doubt about that. But I also think there's a more structural question in China, which is that effectively they're beginning to move into a consumer-based economy. And of course, consumers, have a different sort of set of mentalities than perhaps previously they might have expected. So there's a lot of adjustment to be done in China. My own view is that the number is probably lower than the official number, but it's hard to tell. And it's very important to watch this ahead because, you know, we are very reliant on China. If China stops buying iron ore, we have a major issue. I guess the trade wars will play out in the medium term. My own view is they probably will, but I think there's plenty of damage to be done in the meantime. And I do expect the GDP numbers in China to continue to be weaker ahead. KBR says, Melbourne's on Channel 9 said 20% home price increases in the next 3 years. It's hard to see how that's going to really play out, I think. Who knows? Could be right, could be wrong. Okay, David. Martin North consistently ignores Brisbane. No, I don't. I've spoken about Brisbane a few times, and let me just do that now for you. So there's a few things going on. Of course, prices have not risen as high in Brisbane, so effectively there is still less of a, if you like, toppiness in the Brisbane market. But you need to split units from houses, and you need to split, I think, inner close to the CBD and further out. So if you go west to places like Toowoomba, there are massive issues there. Mortgage stress is very high. There's a lot of defaults. And, I'm seeing similar trends there to where we were in Western Australia a couple of years ago. Closer in, houses in and around Brisbane doing a little better and indeed are doing positive. And probably will do quite well over the next few months because interest rates are so low and there's still some supply and there's still some demand, although, international investors are less active than they were. Units I'm much more concerned about because we know that there's a big supply of units in and around Brisbane. There's many being discounted at the moment post the election. And we also know that there are a number of builders who are in financial strife up there as well. If you go up to the Gold Coast, see somewhat similar things with units, I think, again, in some degree of difficulty. Houses, yeah, probably okay. But I am concerned about the high-rise sector particularly because the same issues of planning, the same issues of default of faults are there. And in fact, you may have seen that in one of my posts, we discussed issues specifically relating to the Gold Coast and some of the poor construction there. So it's just tricky to sort of work all this out. What I would say to you is that I haven't yet found anybody who can give me chapter and verse on the Brisbane market on an ongoing basis. If there's anybody interested in doing that, if you're in the real estate sector and you want to tell me about it, happy to do that. I'm always on the lookout for additional correspondence to be able to actually go into more detail because we have to get granular to really understand what's going on. And the final thing to say that Brisbane is not Queensland. So if you look up broader in Queensland, up, go up towards the Bowen Basin, up around some of the more northern areas, there are way more difficulties up there. And again, I'm seeing somewhat similar circumstances to that in Western Australia. We did a post on Mandurah quite recently with John Adams and Robbie Barwick from the CEC. Mandurah is a real canary in the coal mine in terms of what happens when mortgage stress gets out of hand and what happens 2 years later or thereabouts. I'm seeing similar levels of stress in places like Toowoomba and further up the coast in northern Queensland. And therefore, my belief is that we're going to see significant issues there. The drought will not help either. Whereas Brisbane, I think, is probably a little more insulated. But, I would be very careful because I don't think that there is sufficient justification to be claiming that there are going to be significant prices at the moment, price rises ahead at the moment. That's my view anyway. Okay. What else? No units have been built in Brisbane since 2014, says David. Is that true? I'm afraid that my intelligence suggests somewhat different. Look at the approval rates and look at the planning approvals that are in there. I think there's a little bit more going on there. David says the math is under supply. Oh, yeah? Okay. Well, show me some numbers on it. because I haven't seen the same evidence that you're seeing. I'm seeing an oversupply, particularly of units. Okay, James says, how is Mandurah tracking relative to the inner suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne? Good question. The mortgage stress is not as bad in the suburban areas of Sydney and Melbourne, but we see hotspots in Campbelltown, we see hotspots in and around Liverpool, in and around Sydney, and in Melbourne, places in the outer suburban, out towards Beaconsfield, for example, and Werribee, places like that. So there are signs of very high levels of stress. And what I keep saying is the sorts of indications that I saw 2 or 3 years ago in places like Mandurah and other places down the West Coast in terms of very high debt-to-income ratios, very large mortgages, concerns about cash flow and employment, all of those things, I'm seeing in some of those outer suburban areas now in both Melbourne and Sydney. Narrowarren's one place that I'm particularly concerned about, Pakenham, places like that. So my theory is that over the next couple of years, unless the economy really turns around and unless we suddenly start seeing income beginning to rise relative to cost of living, and I can't personally see how that's going to happen, but you know, some people would claim that it would. Without it, I can't see that a couple of rate cuts and a little bit of tax break, a tax credit, will actually be enough to turn the economy around. Household budgets are so stretched. And this is what I keep coming back to in my surveys, right? Because I rely on the data I get from my surveys. And the key point is that we keep coming across households who again and again say, income is not enough to cover all my costs and my mortgage repayments. So those households are certainly struggling. Now, there are others who are not, clearly. And overall in the economy, you know, as I made in my post the other day, if you look at the Gini coefficient, not Gini, Gini, an in-joke there, what it shows is that there are household segments that are really struggling with their finances. Many of those have mortgages, and it's that marginal borrower that's the critical trigger. Now, if you go to Mandurah now, what's happened is that the spiral has continued. More people have got themselves into more difficulty. More property investors are now struggling to sell. There are more people in negative equity because home prices have dropped 20 to 30% in places. And that spiral then flows back into weaker economic activity in the location. And so it goes on. I worry that we could be seeing the same over the next 2 to 3 years in some of those outer suburban areas in Sydney and Melbourne, because the data is continuing to build. 32% of households in mortgage stress, higher as ever been. Okay. Stormtrooper, pacifist stormtrooper. Demographic changes, baby boomer retirement is the elephant in the room. Rarely hear you factor this into your analysis. I do actually. Good point. So there's 1 million down traders. Those are people above 55 who are effectively wanting to move into smaller properties as they begin to move into retirement. 1 million, right? Remember, there's about 10 million properties. There's about 9 million households. So 1 million of those are looking to sell over the next 1 to 2 years. The reason they have to sell is because they're now moving into the next stage of their life when effectively they're not earning so much or they're moving into retirement and they want to grab equity out of those properties. Now, if they are going to do that, many of them are saying now in my surveys that this might be the time to try because they think there might be a little bit of uptick in the spring particularly. So I'm expecting some of those down traders to try and sell and get out and release equity. But who's going to buy those properties is my question, right? Because the first time buyers is a much, much smaller proportion. You know, there's about 100,000, 120,000, 130,000, give or take, first time buyers. There are some up traders who may well buy a bigger property, but not enough up traders to meet all the down traders. Property investors, hardly active at all at the moment because the rental returns are so low. You know, rents are down 4% in Sydney over the last year on average. Some postcodes a lot less than that, a lot lower. So I can't work out how the equilibrium between those selling and those buying is going to work out. So I think the baby boomer bulge, as it were, is going to have a very significant impact. We're going to see lots of larger properties for sale without many people wanting to buy them. Therefore, I'm expecting to see prices at the top end begin to continue to fall. Now, there is clearly demand at the bottom end for younger people coming through, and quite often they may not be able to afford to get into the market without some sort of help. But of course, every time help is provided, federal government or whatever, first time buyer grants, whatever, it just lifts home prices again, so it doesn't really solve anything. So we're in this bind where effectively the demographic shifts that we're talking about here become critical. The other point to make, and this is one that people haven't got their heads around either, is that a lot of those people who are now moving into retirement have superannuation. Much of that superannuation is invested into a superannuation fund who will be invested in the stock market, who will be invested in banks, who will be invested in construction and property. And if the property market and the banking sector comes off the boil, not only will the equity in those properties they're trying to sell be depressed, but potentially we will also have the situation where the value of the superannuation is also being squeezed. And okay, they've messed with the deeming rates a little bit and what have you, but with term rate deposits so low as well, I think many people are going to move into a retirement phase of their lives with a much lower financial base than they thought they needed. And if you do the maths at the moment on very low interest rates and the typical returns you can get, you know, if you're lucky, you might get 1 or 2%. You need a large, large capital buffer to be able to generate enough income to stop you actually chewing up your savings relatively soon into retirement. And remember that the demographic time bomb is going to go for a long period of time, because people often will live into their 70s, 80s and 90s. And so this is not a short-term problem. This is a 20 to 30 year problem we've got. And the demographic time bomb is absolutely in my modelling. It's caught also in my surveys. And perhaps I'll do a more detailed post on that later as well, because I think it's a big deal. And thanks for pointing it out. Okay, Rodney's asked about rural prices, regional cities. Yeah, I wish I had more time, because I would love to get into more detail into all the regional centres. What I can say is that if you look at places, for example, Newcastle and Wollongong, which I do look at on a regular basis, and places like Bendigo, there are circumstances there that suggest to me that momentum is continuing to ease. In and around Wollongong, prices are down 7 to 8% from peak, units more so than houses. Newcastle is a bit the same. There's a lot of building going on here, a lot of units being still built in and around Wollongong and in and around Newcastle. And so the supply demand equilibrium is all over the place, and a lot of the other things that I've noticed is that some of the builders in these areas, in these regional centres, are really struggling with cash flow as well. So I don't think that we're going to see a huge bounce in the regional centres. I don't think we're going to see the falls, because we never had the massive run-ups that we had in Sydney and Melbourne. But I think it's going to be a tricky time, and I think it's going to be tricky for quite some time into the future in the regional centres. I also want to highlight again in the rural areas the drought. I'm beginning to factor into my modelling more significant economic impacts of the drought, because it is really flowing through into, for example, higher fruit and vegetable prices already. We're going to see more of that. There are many more businesses in rural settings who are reporting through the SME survey that they're unable to manage their finances simply because the drought is just, you know, basically crushing them. And so I'm very, very concerned about regional and rural Australia. And in a way, a lot of the property spruikers, of course, are just fixated on the main centres. But I agree that there's a really important story to tell in the rural and regional. And look, if there are people out there living in the rural and regional areas and you'd like to tell us your story, reach out. Happy to, feature some of those and get more detailed information to tell the story of this large wide brown land, because I think actually there are some really important stories to be told. Okay, what else? Okay, so we just come up to 9 o'clock. gas towns in Queensland created starting in 2013-14 when the gas boom ended. The boom caused massive price inflation and crashed, and everybody was sucked in at high prices of stuff. That's from Paradigm Shift. Yeah, I agree. The mining up and down is still playing out, right? That's what you're saying. And I'm seeing in some of those areas that you're talking about, prices are down 40, 50, 60%. I saw people buying investment properties at the peak to essentially offer those investment properties for those workers who were there temporarily, and suddenly they've gone away. And, you know, parallels over in Western Australia, if you look at some of the areas in the mining belts there, property prices went really, really high and have dropped away. And there are investment properties now that are down 50 and 60% from their peaks. And there are people who have no chance of getting any rentals on them simply because there's nobody there anymore. So it's part of this boom bust thing that we're talking about. It's created a huge issue, and the knock-on effect in terms of the local economies, in terms of local shops, I think is extremely significant. So Cookie Boy, thank you for that. Here's a fact. 20,157 properties for sale in Sydney. Newcastle and Wollongong have only 1,945 under offer. Yeah, it's very interesting. Certainly, if you drive around some of the areas, you know, surrounding Wollongong, which I do quite regularly because that's where I'm based, there are more for sale signs than previously. I've also spoken to a number of people who actually put their property on the market, couldn't sell, and took it off the market again simply because they couldn't get the price that they wanted. So I think this is still being playing out. You know, in the local area where I am, there is a strong demand for properties right on the coast, and they still command a premium. But if you come inland, it's a completely different ball game, and prices are significantly weaker than they were. Demand is very much off. And one thing that's happened is that people who would have previously not been able to afford to buy within the Sydney domain itself and have to come out, for example, down this way, down to Wollongong, can now buy in places like Sutherland, where prices have dropped 15 or 20%. So people are now buying closer in to the centre of town than previously, and that's having a more negative impact. Plus, unemployment is still a lot higher in these regional areas. And if you look at underemployment in some of these regional towns, it is extremely high, and as is youth unemployment. So there are some significant structural and social issues in these places. And look, I keep sort of wanting to draw parallels, and I think it's important to draw parallels with Mandurah, right? Mandurah was like that 2 or 3 years ago, and it's got worse. I fear that unless we do see an economic bounce and, you know, GDP really take off again, that we're going to see similar echoes in some of these other locations too. Okay, this is Rodney saying, following up on the regional cities, would it be fair to say that regional cities within 2 hours of Melbourne, Sydney, commutable, are totally, are totally different to analyse than ones further away? Yeah, I don't think it's 2 hours. I think it's probably closer in now. It used to be, so at the height of the boom, people couldn't afford to buy it, a bit like what I've just said, within those urban centres, so they had to go further out. Because of the fact that prices have slipped, particularly in and around Sydney, we've seen this, people are now buying closer in. And, you know, I've always held the view that if you want to buy more securely, you can probably do so better by buying closer in, even if you end up with a bit of a smaller property. Because in a falling market, it's the stuff further out, it's the stuff with longer distances, it's the stuff with perhaps less facilities surrounding them that actually tend to wobble first. And that's one of my points. If you look at some of the new suburban centres that have been built relatively recently, a lot are without some of the typical things you'd expect to see. It's just houses after houses after houses. We did a post on Donnybrook quite recently, which made the point that, you know, there wasn't a lot there. And that's part of the point. So people, if they make a choice of, you know, buying somewhere there or buying closer in, where there's perhaps more facilities and, you know, education's better, and there's a bunch of reasons, that's what is happening. And I think the fall in home prices is having quite a profound impact on those outer regions. Okay. What Interesting question from Genevieve. What percentage of bad loans across the country would cause liquidity problems on, say, the two most exposed banks? Well, let's talk about the major banks because they're the ones with the biggest problem. They've got very low default rates at the moment, right? And there's three reasons for that. Firstly, they have bent over backwards when people get into financial difficulty through their hardship schemes and have restructured loans and done quite a lot of different things to try and actually maintain the integrity of their portfolios. We're beginning to see the limitations of that now because prices are still wobbling and in many cases negative equity is an issue, first point. Second point is bad loans. You can have 30-day defaults, 90-day defaults. 30-day defaults means that somebody misses a payment but then recovers. We're seeing a bit more of that. But the 90-day default rates, that's when you have to do something about it because that requires you then to put provisions against them. And it's the 90-day default rates that are rising. And in fact, Moody's and Standard & Poor's both reported higher default rates. They're still quite low. But if you look over in the West, we've now got around a 3% number of defaults there. 3% is getting to the point where it is difficult to cope. And just to give you an example, there are a couple of securitized pools that are actually based in Western Australia where the bank is now concerned, I won't name it, has basically said they're not going to be able to maintain the securitized flows to all investors. And that's a leading indicator of a problem. So you get 3%, then you start having issues. So over in the East Coast, it's a lot lower. It's around 1% plus or minus a bit, depending on where you look. But if we saw the default rates continuing to rise, then I think at around 3% it gets quite difficult. Now, there are things they can do, obviously, to try and help, but there is also another problem. You get to the point where effectively, if so many households are defaulting, then you can't actually go through the process of foreclosure and those sorts of things. And that's what happened in the US. So we had many households in the US that for 4 to 5 years continued to live in a household where they couldn't afford to pay the mortgage because the banks were unable to actually foreclose. And so there's a bunch of other questions that then follow from that, which is, well, what happens? How do you deal with that? Now, if property prices begin to turn around and go up again, then there may be sufficient equity created to be able to actually pay off the mortgage and people can exit and leave. If the property market has momentum. If the property market doesn't have momentum, you have more and more properties for sale. As more properties come on for sale, again, Mandurah's a good example, you suddenly find that effectively prices fall further. As they fall further, more people get into negative equity. As they get into negative equity, they're forced to sell. Therefore, they put more property in the market. So it's that vicious circle, that negative circle, which is what I'm worried about. So the short answer is 3%, I think, is what I'd be looking at. And we're not there yet. Down the East Coast. Another point to make is that the reported data sets are securitized pools. That's a Reserve Bank pool and also the pools reported by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. But they are not typical mortgages, right? They are hand-picked mortgages to go into the securitized pools. So very often, the worst mortgages are not in those securitized pools. And therefore, we don't have much visibility of the real losses. And the final point to make is that there's lenders mortgage insurance, which of course does cover some people with high loan to value loans. And at the moment, the claims ratios for lenders mortgage insurers are rising. They've been rising, not just in the West, but now also in New South Wales, according to recent data that I've seen. So we are seeing the early signs of lenders mortgage insurers having to take some of the weight, as it were, of the defaults that are out there. The banks, of course, get paid off. Remember, of course, the lenders mortgage insurers still reserve the right to go back to the borrower. So effectively, the borrower does not have the debt erased. There is full recourse in Australia, and that means that households ultimately still have to pay. And that's something that I think more people are beginning to wake up to in terms of it being an issue. There we go. Somebody's just asked, can the lenders mortgage insurers go under? Well, in theory, yes. So they've got massive capital at the moment. So certainly the one that's publicly floated, Genworth, they've reported recently quite strong capital growth because of the stock markets have been doing very well. In fact, they're, I think, buying back shares, as I remember. So they do have some capacity to deal with the losses. But of course, over a period of time, if the new business coming in continues to tail away. And frankly, one of the things that people haven't yet figured out is if the government scheme, the 95% loan scheme, comes in for first-time buyers next year, that will take a lot of business away from lenders, mortgage insurers. The new premium flows will be compressed at a time when claims are actually going up. That was precisely what happened in the US. And in the US, a number of lenders, mortgage insurers got into terrible difficulty around the GFC. So they are not immune from difficulty, but in the short term, I think they've got capital buffers to be able to sustain themselves. And of course, lenders, mortgage insurers have to report as a standalone business to APRA. They can't cross-subsidise from other insurance businesses, so they are effectively standalone businesses. Okay. This is one from Metzger. We don't need a central bank. The Fed was enacted in 1913. That was when bankers took control of the currency. Central banks need to be... We can only find prosperity once central banks are gone. Well, yeah, it's a very interesting question. What's the role of a central bank? It's an interesting question, right? Because effectively over the years, central banks have got more and more willing, I guess, to try and control the money supply and to magically keep the economy within its sort of inflation rate. We all know the inflation rate is not 2% or whatever it is. You know, we know it's a lot higher. We know that the inflation numbers are not telling the full story, which means that the Reserve Bank is setting rates too low relative to what they should have set for a long, long time. So around the world, central banks have taken a predominantly strong position, an independent position from politics, and essentially what it means is that they have massive power to influence. Now, it's interesting watching Trump and the Fed, because it's clear to me that there is influence there from the political environment into what the Fed has done. You know, the fact they turned their strategy around in January from the rate rises the previous year is, I think, quite interesting and remarkable, and Trump keeps saying rates should be lower, rates should be lower. There is evidence in Australia, I think, that the Reserve Bank is within the Council of Financial Regulators, sitting down with the Treasurer, Treasury, ASIC, APRA. They all sit around the table and plot what they're going to do. So, independence, how independent, and what is their role? Of course, they've also got their open market operations roles as well, and a lot of other things that they do, some of the supervisory stuff as well. But I personally think it's time to have a deep look at the way that our central banking system works and our supervisors are actually working, because I still don't believe that we've got to the bottom of the critical issues. The Royal Commission last year showed us a little bit, but didn't show us that much. And no one seems willing to really question the fundamental assumptions that are driving the way that the central bank works here. But of course, the central bank here mirrors the operations of central banks in many other places. They're a bit connected through the Bank for International Settlements and the Financial Stability Board. And so you could actually argue that there's this international cartel of banking structures that are playing out a particular agenda. And it tends to be very much monetary based. It tends to be protecting the banking system, financial stability. But as I said earlier on, my worry is that what that does is to create wealth acceleration for a small proportion of the community, but the broader community effectively is getting badly hit. So my own view is there's a big question to be asked about the role of central banks. I think more importantly, we need a bank, an infrastructure bank, a bank that effectively lends for productive infrastructure purposes. And to my mind, that's a separate but critical role that we need. We don't have it at the moment. A lot of the commercial banks are just not up, stepping up to the mark. They're not actually giving the funding that's required to assist businesses. And very importantly, the BIS rules on capital makes mortgage lending so much more efficient from a capital perspective relative to other types of lending. And so I actually think that as well as the role of central banks, we should be asking about the role of the BIS and those capital rules that have been in place for some time, because I am not sure that even those are actually doing us a great service. So good question. Can't answer it any further than that at the moment, but I think there is a good question to ask there. Okay. Cooker Boys just highlighted the fact that Perth is down 0.44% in July. Yeah, they're hitting 20% now, but that's an average, right? And remember, I keep saying to everybody, averages lie, right? There are areas in and around Perth where prices have dropped 30 to 35%. There are others where they've dropped less. So you have to get granular. You have to actually go into the individual postcodes and look at the individual types of properties to understand what's going. North Ryde, more than 30% down, particularly units. Falls in Sutherland, as I mentioned earlier on, you know, quite significant now, 15 to 17 to 18% in some places, some more. So it's really important to understand that these averages that are reported don't necessarily tell you much. You have to get granular, I think. Okay, 9:21, we're close to the end, I think. Let's see what else is there. Okay, what happens to people who own bank shares if a bail-in occurs? That's from Chris. Good question. Okay, so bail-in. Of course, bail-in is designed to support a bank that gets into difficulty before it fails. All right? That's really important to understand. There's a difference between bail-in and bail-out. A bail-out is when a bank has fallen over. A bail-in is essentially to inject more capital into a bank to enable it to continue to grow and continue to trade. Now, if you're an existing shareholder and suddenly depositors, for example, or bondholders are converted to shareholders, then you have massive dilution of your shares. So the value of each share will drop. It'll probably drop anyway, because, of course, the question will be the liquidity of the bank and those sorts of things. But in addition to that, there is the dilution of those shares. So an existing bank shareholder will see the value of their shares drop significantly and be diluted. The second question then is, well, if you've got deposits that are bailed in and you then become a shareholder, right, can you get out again? Or are you stuck as a shareholder of the bank, even if you don't want to be? And the answer is no one knows, because there's no guidance, there's no rules about this at all, nothing that's ever been put out there by APRA. But certainly around the world, we quite often see cases where effectively those deposits are converted for shares and people have to hold shares for a number of years before they can do anything. They may not even be able to actually extract the value, so they're stuck. They're prisoners, if you like, as shareholders in the bank. And the other interesting question is, if you do bail in a bank, there's no guarantee that it's going to be able to survive. So what happens once you've done the bailing in? Good question. Now, there's a lot to be said about bail-in, which I'm not going to do tonight because it's getting too near the end of the show. But we are going to do some more shows on bail-in. There's some very important material that we've got, specifically around the changes to the bank's terms and conditions that are now being rolled out. You may have recently received revised terms and conditions for your own bank account. Read them. You'll see that there are some interesting changes that basically leaves the door more open to bail-in than previously. Okay, 9:24. I'm getting close to the end. Okay, Alain says, if QE doesn't address the core problem, why are reserve banks continuing to do it? What is required for them to stop? Well, you should watch the Steve Keen interviews that I did with him. Steve Keen really explained wonderfully well why it is that the central banks are doing what they're doing. It's because they've got a flawed view of the way the economy works. Basically, their view is that credit is not important, because every time money's lent, you create an asset and a liability and it cancels each other out, so therefore the net effect is zero, right? So they're not worried about the amount of debt in the system. They're not worried about the fact that you can go on lending forever. And in fact, Guy Debelle last year said, we don't know how much debt is too much. Steve Keen's response to that was, I can tell you that what we've got is too much debt and we need a lot less debt than we had. Watch his show. I think it's really quite an interesting conversation. So the fact of the matter is that if you are actually of the view that the economy works in a particular way and you don't believe that debt's a problem and that you can encourage more people to borrow more at ultra low rates, you can blow the asset bubble up a bit quicker, you can actually inflate banks more, so effectively it looks superficially as though the economy is doing well, stock market high, all those things, then effectively at one level you could actually argue that you've succeeded. But you haven't succeeded because you haven't solved the debt problem, right? And at the moment I can see no evidence anywhere of central banks around the world really wanting to get to debt get to grips with the debt issue. Interestingly, the BIS in their annual report did say that the debt-led approach to dealing with growth was actually flawed. Very interesting. And indeed, Steve Keen made the point that the BIS has a different view from a lot of other people in central bank land about the function of debt and the fact that there are limits to how debt can actually support the economy. But there are other options, but none of them are palatable. So the question is, do you do more of the same? You know, wash, rinse, recycle, wash, rinse, recycle, take rates ever lower, lend ever more, stoke the debt bubble a bit more, lift home prices a little bit maybe, lift stock prices definitely, make the rich richer. You know, that's the model basically at the moment, and everybody's buying into that from central bank land. Is that the right model? No, it's not. Are there alternatives? Well, certainly there are. And again, look at Steve Keen's posts to discuss some of those, particularly around things like debt forgiveness or, you know, other structures, other alternatives. But we are in a very dangerous situation with so much debt. And this is more debt than we've ever had. And therefore, the risks are very high. And yet, QE is still on the table. Okay, who decides bail-in or bail-out? That depends on whether it's a gone or going concern. If it's a gone concern, then it's effectively a way to try and actually, you know, deal with it. If it's a going concern, then yeah, you could get government help, which is what happened around the time of the QE. A lot of the 10 years around GFC, you know, a lot of banks were given money from the government. So there were banks that were nationalized to keep them going. So that was bailing in. Bailing in is what's been put in to try and replace that government assistance. So the argument went, we can't afford to put taxpayers' money into the banking system to rescue the banks in a crisis. We just can't afford to do it. The impact on the broader economy is devastating. Therefore, we need a different path. The bail-in path was part of a resolution plan that included things like a living will for a bank, so that effectively they could plot its management through a crisis. Bailing in could be types of bonds, convertibles, hybrids, or maybe even deposits. In New Zealand, it's clearly deposits, and that's one of the issues that Joe Wilkes and I have been talking about a few times. In Australia, it's more muddy, although we still think that the door is open for bailing in deposits. Ultimately, I suspect it will be APRA who will make some sort of call on that. But remember that the whole point of bail-in was to avoid taxpayers' money bailing out a bank. And that has been the IMF's agenda. That's been the FSB's agenda since the global financial crisis, because they're trying to avoid a repeat of what happened in 2007, 8 and 9. But in doing so, my view is they're actually building a whole bunch of new problems. And by the way, most people don't understand that bail-in, if it happens, could have a profound impact on their savings and on their banks. Okay. How are we doing? Nicholas says, care to estimate when we could see hyperinflation? Well, you know, hyperinflation is certainly possible. So if QE and negative interest rates plays out, asset inflation follows, we could see it maybe two or three years down the track. Difficult to tell, really. When you lose confidence in the currency is the critical thing. At the moment, our currency is still relatively stable. It's around 70 cents, dropped down a little bit. And that's because we are in an environment where rates are being cut around the world, and our iron ore exports mean that our economy, from an international perspective, looks reasonable. If that changes, if in fact the debt does get out of hand, if we lose our AAA rate, you know, AAA rating, for example, all those sorts of things, if we could suddenly find that effectively the currency is significantly devalued. If it's significantly devalued, we'll import inflation. That will create potentially a sort of a circle of hyperinflation, so we could have very high inflation rates. That's one scenario. The other one is very low inflation. And you might want to read John Adams' posts he's put on his own channel, his own website, I should say, where he's gone through these different scenarios, because there is a scenario of hyperinflation, there's a scenario of very low inflation. So somewhere between those, or somewhere in the middle, is the potential truth. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to go back to finish off the rest of the show here, and I'll just come back for one last look, and then from there we'll round it off. So just in terms of DFA, you can find a lot more about DFA on the DFA blog. A lot of material there. You can subscribe to get more information from us, and you get alerts on all the things that we publish. You can also support our work. I mentioned earlier on how critical the support is, because essentially we don't make money out of doing this. We basically spend every dollar we get making more content, and I'm very appreciative of all those who support us via Patreon. We've got more than 230 subscribers now. Been growing again. Paul, thank you very much. Really appreciate that. The Patreon thing also allows you to get access to some additional content as well, and there are various tiers, so have a look at that. Or via PayPal, if you want to make a one-off donation, and that's a simple way to do it. And again, a few people have chosen to do that route. Thank you so much for that. Or indeed, even with Bitcoin, because people kept asking, can you do Bitcoin? So we do Bitcoin as well, and you can get the details there. Just quickly, some top hits. The economic massacre of Mandurah. This is what I mentioned earlier on. This is a really important show because we went through in detail. It's actually on the Interest of the People channel with John Adams and Robbie Barwick. Do have a look at that. You'll be shocked. There's a show I did with Joe Wilkes on the accidental landlord and the equity trap, which I think is really important. It contains... Dennis, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Thank you. There's some really important stuff there in terms of people who get trapped into being an investment a homeowner by mistake. The series with Steve Keen, there's three up already, one on debt, one on MMT and all those sorts of things, and one on his broader thoughts around the way that energy and the ecology debate needs to be thought about. There's one more post I got from Steve. It'll go up in the next few days, and that's where we're talking about data, and we're comparing some of the data that I have and he has. Genie Out of the Bottle, that's where we looked at the household wealth distribution. Genie is actually a pun. A lot of people didn't get that, I'm afraid, on the original post. Genie is a metric of relative fairness or lack of fairness in household income distribution. Household financial confidence, tanks and more, we reported that quite recently, and we also looked at the employment numbers. So DFA will continue to do its deep dive into the various pieces of analysis data, but we also do these broader things too, particularly with some of our other network of contacts, and there's quite a lot more coming there. I'm going to cover the US some more. I've got more from Joe in New Zealand, and I've got some other people to put up as well. So plenty more content to come. Do share those posts, do like them, or if you don't like them, please, you know, react to them, because effectively that helps us to get the really helps the the population. Okay, so that's it really. I want to say thank you very much for spending the time with me tonight. I'm just going to have one last look back over the okay. So there's one last question there. John Adams, do a gold smackdown with Robbie Barwick. Yes, there's some more conversations we had about gold. We might well come onto that, probably on the IOTP channel. And somebody's there asked, very long name, what about buying a first house in the Central Coast north of Sydney? Should we wait as prices could go down further? Yeah, Central Coast is really interesting. Prices have been sliding in there. Mortgage stress is high. My own perspective on there would probably be, unless you see a real, real, real good offer, I'd hang on, because I think you're going to see more property for sale up in the Central Coast. It's one of the areas I've been watching. I will actually probably do a post on that. I've got a bunch of questions which I haven't been able to answer tonight from people who ask specific things. Again, sorry about that. We did touch a few of those things, but I will actually put some of those together. And I have a number of people who asked more specific questions around sort of, you know, financial planning and how to protect themselves. I'll make a post on that because, again, I was going to talk about that tonight, but I haven't done so because I ran out of time. Unfortunately, there's always more to talk about than time to spend, I'm afraid. Okay, so I think that's pretty much it. Let me just have one last look. Rodney says, do you expect an increase in people putting in grant flats? Yeah, it's happening already. So that's another way of getting more income. We expect more of that. You're right on that one. Okay. Yeah. And Jade says, Heisei expects long stagnation. Yeah, I'm of the view that Japan is probably the closest analog to what we're going to see because I just have that sort of sense of all of the things beginning to play out the same way. So I could be wrong, but I think stagflation is probably more likely than hyperinflation. Anyway, I want to say thank you very much for your spending the time with me. I hope you found this a useful session. And I think without further ado, it's time to say thank you very much. Have a good evening. Do check in again next month. I'll be doing something similar. I'm also thinking about perhaps doing a live stream with Joe in New Zealand on New Zealand specific issues. We've got a lot to talk about in New Zealand. There's a lot going on there. is my offset account affected by bail-in? No, Brian, it's not, I'm pleased to say. So thank you very much for that. Have a good evening. And I'm just going to play the outro now. And it's Martin North from Digital Finance Index signing off. We'll see you next time.